Today in Flex in the City, we talk to Laurie Spengler, Courageous Capital Advisors, LLC. All that happening right now in Flex and the City.
Hello, everybody. This is Rachel Treese for Flex and the City. And I'm absolutely thrilled to have with me this afternoon, Laurie Spengler. Laurie is the founder and CEO of Courageous Capital Advisors, beautiful title for her company. And she's also an impact investment banker and field builder. Laurie, thank you for joining us on Flex in the City this afternoon.
Rachel, it's delightful to be here. Thank you so much for inviting me.
You're very welcome. So I do know a little bit about you, Laurie, but I'd love you to share with our listeners a little bit about your journey from working in the USA to coming to Europe and doing this wonderful job that you're doing.
Well, thank you. Sure. It's always a little bit awkward when we're at this stage of our career and we look back and say, gosh, what were those twists and turns and how did you get there? But maybe what I'll do, Rachel, is reverse engineer it if I can.
Yeah, absolutely.
You just mentioned, so I'm currently the founder and CEO of a company called Courageous Capital Advisors. And I set up that company in January of 2020, just as the pandemic was unfolding, as one does. And the motto of the firm is to push beyond your comfort zones and that actions speak louder than words. And I really took that to heart by starting a company in the midst of, or at least at the early days of what has turned out to be quite a long global pandemic. And I think that backdrop really speaks to what I'm endeavoring to do at Courageous Capital Advisors, which I think we'll circle back to, but really go further and deeper on impact themes and topics and things that can really move the needle for change, for positive change in the world around us. But how did I get to there? And I currently am based in the UK. That's how you and I have gotten to know each other. Based in the UK, do work globally. And actually, I've lived outside my country of origin, which is the United States, longer than I have in my country as a professional. So I kind of crossed that line, which is always, again, also a bit of a reflection point. But how did I get to this point? Just prior to Courageous Capital Advisors, I was the CEO of two companies. They were run on a single platform, the Include platform. We had Include Limited, which was an advisory services firm, and then Include Capital, which was one of the first regulated investment banks for impact. So FCA regulated and really on the sell side of what we would call the impact capital industry. And I built those two companies over really almost a 15-year period with the hypothesis that advisory services alone are not enough to address the impact opportunities and challenges that we need. But similarly, capital alone is not enough. And so I really have this conviction, which I maintain, that capacity and capital need to be woven together. So I grew those two firms. They were acquired by Palladium, and Palladium now continues to manage those firms. And as any good entrepreneur, when you build something and you sell it, you exit. And so very smoothly and with a lot of goodwill, I did exit to set up Courageous Capital Advisors. But how I got to Include, I think, is also interesting. I found my way into Include really through a couple of values-based banks. Okay. Shore Bank in the United States, which goes back to your US question, which was the first community development financial institution, so CDFI, which is a regulated bank like any other regulated bank, but with a particular focus and commitment to serve low-income communities. So Shore Bank and Triodos Bank out of the Netherlands. And so I've had a long-standing familiarity and relationship with on the commercial banking side, not just the investment banking side, with what we would call, you and I would call, values-based, values-driven financial institutions. And that's been a deeply satisfying part of my life. And so I actually built Include on the platform of Shore Bank and Triodos, which was a true privilege, I have to say. And then prior to joining Shore Bank, I actually was running my own firm in Central and Eastern Europe. I lived in Prague in Central Europe. So I moved there shortly after the wall fell, and I moved with a very large firm out of New York, but then ultimately being the daughter of an entrepreneur, I found my entrepreneurial legs and set up a firm based in Prague, but working in 12 markets of Central and Eastern Europe with a similar notion of how do we support small businesses and grow community finance in those markets. So those are kind of a few of the milestones, if you will, Rachel. I probably should say that I have a background in law and finance, because it goes a bit to my notion of capacity and capital. I really believe you need a multidisciplinary approach to really attend to some of the most relevant and urgent needs in society. And that's been a kind of a professional commitment that I made to myself early on.
Very good. So without this sounding like a pun, I love your courage as a leader. And I know that you've recently been involved in the G7 and you're doing all kinds of things in the field. So just tell me a little bit about what you're also doing, you know, outside of the day job, Laurie.
Yeah, thanks. Thanks, Rachel. I appreciate that. And yeah, I've thought for a long time that working in purpose-driven organizations, it's highly consuming, highly demanding, and incredibly fulfilling. But I've always believed, Rachel, that it was incumbent upon us as practitioners to also look for opportunities to contribute to the broader field, where mm-hmm. those activities are not necessarily about you or even your own organization or the organization where you're working, but really trying to mobilize a lot of actors who are allies in championing ultimately the cause mm-hmm. and the destination that you're working towards. And in impact investing, we've just seen a ballooning of those types of opportunities over the past couple of decades. And so for me personally, Rachel, in addition to some boards that I sit on, which we can come back to, but in terms of field building organizations, where these are mostly pro bono or voluntary contributions that one makes, I do sit on the board of the UK Impact Investing Institute. Mm-hmm. I'm a global ambassador for the Global Steering Group on Impact Investing. And it was really through those two associations I was invited to serve on the G7 Impact Task Force that you just mentioned. But I'm also an advisor to the Gender Smart Council, which I'm really excited about, Suzanne Beagle's organization, the Gender Smart Community, which I feel just very passionate about the work that they have been doing, and a few others. So that gives you a feel for the kinds of things that I'm involved in. And what I like to say is systems change is a team sport. And so we need lots of team members. And I learn so much through those activities. And I think that's just a real privilege to always be learning as you're doing work.
I couldn't agree with you more, Laurie. And so in your time within, you know, this industry, both in commercial and investment banking, you know, you must have come across so many leaders. Is there a leader that you'd like to highlight and say, wow, this person had an impact on me, or I love the way this person shows up? Is there someone you could...
There is, Rachel. I mean, as I'm sure for your career as well, there are many. But there is for me a real standout person who has influenced me significantly on multiple levels. And that would be Sir Fosley Abbott, who is the founder of BRAC, the largest development organization in the world. And BRAC also has a constellation of related entities, BRAC Bank, Bcash, a whole host of financial services operating entities, but beyond financial services as well. BRAC really adopts a holistic approach to meeting the needs of poor people around the globe. And I had the privilege of working since 2005 with Abed. Sadly, Abed, we call him Abed Pai, he passed away at the end of 2019. And I was honored by the family to be invited to deliver a eulogy. It was my last international trip before the pandemic. I flew to Dhaka and participated in the memorial service for Abed. But he was just an amazing individual. And I've asked myself, you know, why? And I think there are several reasons, Rachel. He taught me a couple of critical lessons. One is learning what we were just talking about, that our job really is to listen and observe and learn through listening and observing. And then in delivering our financial services, adapt as we're delivering, because you've been listening and you've been observing. And so there's a solutions-driven notion to what you're doing. He taught me the lesson of purpose, that really our resources, our time, our money, our energy, our skills really are in service of something other than our self-interest, mm-hmm. that the hunt for purpose is really the pull to that collective need. And Abed just displayed that in everything that he did. The lesson of integrity, mm-hmm. that it's not about a single heroic act of time or energy, it's a lifetime of consistency and reliability in the integrity of your actions. And the most impactful for me is the lesson of humility. Mm. And Abed was fiercely ambitious in terms of the institutional achievements for what? For the outcomes for people. He was a deeply humble individual and really, I think, exemplified what I think a lot of people now refer to perhaps as servant leadership. Yeah. But the world is blessed to have had Abid for as long as we did, 83 years. I personally feel that my life has been extraordinarily blessed by knowing Abid.
Wow. So I imagine that a lot of the things that you've just described probably sit with your own core values and your purpose and what motivates you. Am I right?
You're right. You're right, Rachel. You're right. I mean, I think Abid in some ways pulled things out of me. So mm-hmm. I recognized things in him that were all very much aligned with how I was endeavoring to live my life, Rachel, how I was endeavoring to build the businesses that I was leading. But certainly he augmented that challenge, that reinforced it in many ways. And I really, it's so wonderful to have that gift of working with someone who is challenging you and mm-hmm. pulling you in ways that where you want to go. But again, what I said at the beginning, we've got to all move beyond our comfort zone. And Abid certainly pushed me to move beyond my comfort zone.
Fantastic. So impact investing, it's a word that is used fairly regularly within this broad industry. But if you were to add your own spin to this, Laurie, and if you were to be, you know, helping perhaps some young people know what impact investing is, how would you bottom line it? How would you describe it?
Yeah, thanks, Rachel. I mean, I think, to be honest, I mean, first of all, the word investing is part of it. So it's very important that we're investing. So there's a capital investment, which means that there's an expectation of the return trip of capital. The money is, you expect the money to come back. But the real notion of impact investing is that we recognize money is in pursuit of something more than just making money. The whole point is that we are using money to pursue and to achieve a positive environmental, social, developmental result. So we do expect the return trip of that capital, yes, but we are absolutely have the intention and the expectation that we will be generating a positive result more than the financial result. And that, I think, is really defined by what are you pursuing? What problem are you solving with that capital? That's the question that I always ask myself, Rachel, which means I have the intention. People talk a lot about intentionality with impact investing. Well, if you frame the question of what problem am I solving with the capital, obviously you have an intention to do something with that money more than making money. But also there's a notion of accountability. By framing it as a question, you are going to hold yourself accountable. In impact investing, we talk a lot about measuring the impact. So again, I like that question frame for me personally, because I know that I'm seeking a solution. And I'm going to be holding myself accountable. What am I learning? What am I achieving as a result of that?
Do you think leaders in the financial services industry truly understand what sustainability actually truly means?
Boy, that's a tough one, Rachel. I think that I think if I take a general half a step back, I think there is absolutely a growing awareness and certainly a growing desire to know what sustainability means. But a little bit like my reference about Abid, there are so many dimensions to long-term sustainability. There's a temporal dimension. There's a climate dimension. There's a social dimension. Because I think these things are integrated and not separate. So there's a complexity, not overwhelmingly, but thoughtful complexity in really identifying the drivers of sustainability. So I think big picture, Rachel, more and more people, I think it's very, very rare you'd find a leader who says, I'm against sustainability, right? I'm anti-sustainability.
Yes.
But your question is going deeper. Do they really understand what it means? And then importantly, how to run their organizations in alignment with the principles of sustainability. And that I would say we're really, it's work in progress, but I am hopeful because more and more people are absolutely willing to devote time, energy, and effort to thinking about what does that mean internally for my organization and also externally in terms of the strategy I might be pursuing in my organization. So I would characterize it as work in progress, Rachel, but certainly with a receptivity, a greater receptivity to understanding what it really means and what I need to do as a leader than we might have had even a couple of years ago.
Yeah. And what do you see as being the biggest shifts? Where do you think the industry is going with this? Or what do you hope?
Well, I'm quite excited coming out of this last cop. And I think also informed by the experience that we've all had in living with a global pandemic, a recognition that climate and social are not separate pursuits. Climate objectives, the net zero agenda that has certainly galvanized a lot of people around the globe, cannot be pursued without understanding the communities, the individuals, the households, the places, the social fabric in which a net zero achievement will ultimately take place. And that's not just about low-income communities, although it is absolutely the case that oftentimes pollution and environmental violation affects those who are the most vulnerable financially, the worst. And we see that in every country around the globe. You and I are talking here in the UK today, but this is true of every country around the globe. But it's not only that. I think across the board, there is a greater recognition or beginning, and maybe I should say it better, Rachel, a beginning to see that climate and social need to be together. This last COP, which I did have the privilege to attend, absolutely that narrative was coming to the fore. And I think we're going to see more of that, Rachel. And I think, frankly, from a financial services point of view, we should be pushing for more of that.
Absolutely. And so if we're talking about the future, we need to touch on the younger generations. And I think, as I've mentioned to you, Laurie, I've had a lot of young people saying, well, I'm not so interested in financial services. But clearly, impact is massively purposeful. What advice would you give to young, bright generations, you know, who are hungry to help our planet and our world? You know, what advice would you give them about entering the industry and getting involved in the impact side of things?
Yeah, I also get the question a lot, and I appreciate it from young people, because I also really appreciate that they're so motivated by impact. I mean, that's the kind of that's where they want to spend their time. But I would say a couple of things. First of all, money is a very powerful tool. Money is not an end in and of itself. Money should be in service of society, should be in service of people and planet. And I think if you embrace that approach and hold true to it, really feel convicted about that, I think that gives you an incredible amount of confidence and flexibility in where you develop your professional skills. So point one is recognizing that money is a powerful tool, but it is in service of people and planet, and hold on to that. I do think in financial services, especially in the larger institutions, there's no question there's an incredible opportunity to get training around financial tools, financial regulations, mm-hmm. financial services. And if you follow my logic flow, if, you know, money is a big, powerful tool, well, understanding how to utilize that tool, there's a certain skill set. There's just some learnings that I need to achieve. I commenced my career working for a very large international law firm. I knew I would not stay there because I had my purpose convictions already formed in my own mind. But I went there and I worked with some fantastic people. And I learned some skills that I took with me when I set up my first business that have stayed with me my entire professional career. So I would encourage young people to think about acquiring the best skills they can. And then the third point I would say, Rachel, is I think there are some examples of financial institutions that are definitely moving in alignment with principles of sustainability. You and I have talked about the Global Alliance for Banking on Values, and many at Triodos Bank, BRAC Bank, Southern Bank Corp. These are financial institutions. They may be medium-sized financial institutions, but they are absolutely fully aligned with principles of sustainability. And that's how they organize themselves internally. Those are the strategies they pursue externally. And tremendous, well, short-term opportunities, but career opportunities with those. With the more quote-unquote mainstream, non-maybe values-aligned institutions, even within that, there are pockets. There are either divisions, units, teams. There's opportunity to find fellow allies inside some of the larger financial institutions. So the final thing I would say, Rachel, is that I was given some very good advice early on, is that we are in charge. We individually are in charge of our own career. And we shouldn't be afraid to pursue career experiences while we're weaving those experiences together, because we are our own storyteller and we are the ones who build our own career. So taking a job with a financial institution for 2 to 4 years, 3 to 5 years does not define who you are. It doesn't define who you are. You define who you are. And I do think there are some really exciting changes underway, certainly in a segment of the financial services industry, and maybe that'll catch on to all.
I absolutely love what you're saying there, Laurie, in terms of you showing up as a leader. So how do you facilitate the growth of people around you? Because I know that this is a core part of who you are. How do you facilitate that growth?
Well, the learning proposition that, first of all, I recognize we're all learning, including myself. So whatever title I have or position I have, I really, and this is reflecting back on my work with Abid, but I generally try to bring that learning approach. If you do that, it allows you to display vulnerability, because you don't know everything. I don't know everything. And also the world is changing very quickly. So a learning culture and agenda, which then allows greater, I think, receptivity and participation by young people or people who are newer to the field. So setting that tone, that culture in your organization, I think is very important. I think it's deeply satisfying personally, but I think that's important. The other thing I would say, Rachel, is that I'm very motivated to make sure that colleagues I work with have exposure beyond what they're doing in our projects. So on our transactions or our projects in the firm, I really want to make sure that they're exposed to other things. And so just like I shared my field building participation in activities, I really encourage the young people in my firm to make sure that they're spending some time, energy, and effort outside of the firm, not only in the firm. I think it's great for perspective. Obviously, it's good for networking, but it's great for learning. But I think it's that perspective point that I think is so important. And I think no matter where we are, inevitably, we put so much energy into what we're doing, day to day, we can sometimes narrow our perspective unintentionally. And I think the challenges of the world today require us always to be expanding our perspective, not narrowing our perspective. So those are some of the things that I try to do.
Yeah, I love that you're talking about perspectives. For us at the Henker Institute, it's all about perspectives and looking at things from different angles. So I'm now going to give you the most beautiful angle possible and give you a magic wand. And you have the magic wand where you can make a change overnight within this broad industry. So if you, Laurie, had that perspective, what would change overnight?
Oh my gosh. So overnight, I know, and how exciting, and thank you for inviting the magic wand. So overnight, a couple of things. It's a multi-pronged answer, if I might, Rachel, but not too long. One is recognizing what I call the push of the market. We need mandatory regulation, not voluntary. Mandatory regulation, consistent regulation on impact disclosures. So that just get transparency, critical impact disclosure. I don't care what kind of investor or investment institution you are, mandatory. That would be one. That's the push of the market. The pull of the market, I would love to see asset managers competing on impact. And now we have we have a segment of managers who do that, but I would love all managers to be competing out of the gate. And then the incentive structures inside the institutions, either their own institutions or larger institutions, to be aligned with rewarding and recognizing their impact delivery, their positive impact delivery, I should qualify to be clear. And then the third, and this is the tougher one, but if I had a magic wand, I would like what I would really call the asset owners, the people who have the decision-making authority over money, to pivot and to behave in a way that shows they understand money is in service of people and the planet. And that's the harder one, but that would be, if I had a magic wand, I would like their kind of world order behavioral hierarchy to be inverted. I mean, I think people will, as I said at the beginning about sustainability, I don't think anybody would reject that desire, but it's not the default defining proposition in how they make their decisions. And I would, on the behavioral side, which is the hardest one, that's why I led with the other two. Yeah. I would love to see that.
Yeah, that's why we do the work we do. It's all about behaviors, isn't it?
It is.
Absolutely. It is. So yeah. When you're not involved in the G7 and running your company, is there anything outside of financial services that gives you enormous pleasure?
Yes. I love hiking. And I love hiking. And I didn't grow up as a hiker. It wasn't something that my family was exposed to. I grew up in New Jersey. Not that we didn't have hiking opportunities, but it wasn't something my family did. And so I've come to hiking as an adult later in my life. And gratefully, my husband really enjoys hiking as well. He's a former professional athlete, which I'm not going to compete with him on sports. So we do hiking. And what I love about it, Rachel, there's always a destination. So I feel like I'm striving to get somewhere. I love being in the natural environment. I love being in places that I'm not familiar with. So I love hiking places I don't know, because there's that sense of discovery, which I really find satisfying. And because my work is global, I've been able to incorporate some hiking activities as I have been traveling in my work. So that just adds another dimension of satisfaction to hiking. So that's something I really hope to be able to continue.
Fantastic. And so, what could financial services learn from the joy of hiking?
A lot, I would say. One is, I've been talking a lot over the past year plus about the power of place. Mm. And I really do feel for all of our work, and then specifically with financial services, it is so important to understand the place where your money is hopefully trying to do some good. And it's the people in that place, but it's the dynamics of that place. I mean, one aha, Rachel, that I thought was very interesting in the United States, it was during COVID that somehow people rediscovered community development financial institutions as if they were a new thing. We've had CDFIs in America for 30 plus years. And someone described them as the local capillaries. That if you're trying to kind of get blood running through the full system, you need those local capillaries, and which I thought was a lovely image, I have to say, so vibrant to how we're surviving in society. But the only reason those CDFIs really work, or one of the primary reasons, I should say, is because they really understand the communities they're serving. They know the communities. They understand people's needs. And I do think in financial services, sometimes we become so removed from proximity and place. We kind of lose the plot. And the product or service that we are offering, even with our best of intentions, is just not aligned with the needs of that community. It's not actually enhancing, supporting the needs. So I really think we've got to be much better in listening, learning, observing, and responding to the needs of place and the people in place. And that's something from hiking, would be a carry forward to financial services.
Fantastic. Laurie Spangler, I just want to, first of all, thank you for being on Flex in the City. I want to acknowledge your courage, your intention, and your purpose. Thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, Rachel, thank you so much. I thoroughly enjoyed the conversation. Thank you.
You just listened to Flex in the City. Catch us on our next episode.